Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another Motorsport Magazine podcast in association with Mercedes-Benz.
Some things are made to cope with puddles and rain. Others deal with the stickiest of mud. And as for the snow, that takes a warm coat and sure footing. But when it comes to dealing with all conditions, there's only one thing that springs to mind. Mercedes-Benz 4MATIC. All-wheel drive performance in any condition. So whatever the weather or road throws at you, you're ready. To see the 4MATIC range for yourself, visit your local Mercedes-Benz retailer.
I'm Ed Foster, and we have an absolute treat for you today. The eagle-eyed amongst you will realise that we are not in Motorsport HQ. We are, in fact, at Goodwood in Lord March's office. Lord March, thank you so much for having us here and for sparing so much of your time.
Pleasure. Very nice to be here.
I just jump in and say now that we're also joined by veteran podcaster and Goodwood man, Morning. Rob Widdows, and behind the camera, Alan High. Thank you so much for recording us, as always. Lord March, I wanted to start with your grandfather. He obviously was sort of steeped in motorsport and was an extremely good driver. And is that where the motorsport passion came from? Because I think you used to watch racing with him as a young child.
Certainly, absolutely, yes. I come down here twice a year for the horse racing in July and the Easter Monday motor racing meeting. And that was the kind of highlight for me. And he would sort of take me under his wing a bit and take me around. And the drivers, a lot of the drivers were here anyway, in the house, and he exactly instilled the bug. He'd send me the magazines at school, and my grandmother, I think, too, was very good at keeping it. So she was probably the person who nurtured that relationship, really, kept sending the stuff and getting him sort of motivated too. But
he was, from what I can read about him, he was a really interesting man, because he not only was he obviously the racer and so involved in motorsport, but he spent a bit of time at Bentley Motors in the service department, but he was known as Mr. Setrington, and no one knew who he really was. Is that true?
Yeah, absolutely. He left Oxford very early, much to his parents' fury, and he was riding his bike. I think he was doing that famous standing quarter mile outside Oxford all the time on his motorbike. And he left Oxford early and got a job on the shop floor. He did rise to the sales department, I think, and then of course he set up his own dealership in Berkeley Square. But when he started off first, there was a famous story of him lying underneath some car, and the mechanic with him saying, "I think there's some bloody lord here, isn't there, working here? Do you know who it is?" He was saying, "No idea."
He was also he was a good engineer and a good designer as well. I mean, you know, he's in a way his reputation, what he did, is sort of undervalued still in some ways.
Yeah, I agree. I think he was very, very innovative in terms of the technology that he not only developed a little bit but also really enjoyed. He loved small, clever cars. You'll notice, all the cars he raced. Were all sort of, he didn't race Bentleys or even drive them. He liked sort of small, clever, new design, new technology. And I mean, we had one of the very first Minis here when it first came out. My grandmother was absolutely terrifying in it. In fact, she wasn't allowed to go out of the park, I don't think, in it. But I remember it zooming up and down out here, a little red Mini, and he had always had, you know, sort of small, clever cars, and Dan Richmond always tuned them up. Downton Engineering always tuned the hell out of them. And so they went like stink, all of them, but they looked very ordinary. But also his, you know, I've got quite a few of his cars, and the lovely AC I've got, the pre-war AC he designed. And, you know, he was very much, a lot of people have been, you know, very positive about the influence he had, and have talked to me a lot about, you know, his role in terms of English sports car design. The sort of double scuttle front was very much his sort of signature, the slab tank on the back. He had very much a look, and he was a very good designer. He drew very well. He's a good artist. And so it was unusual, I think, in that he was both very artistic and a good engineer. He built his own aeroplane, flew and built his own aeroplane, you know, which is no mean feat, really, is it?
Amazing. There's I discovered an article in Motorsport by Mike Lawrence from probably a couple of decades ago now, and he was telling a story about how your grandfather had to deal with the customer complaints and things as he moved up to the service department. And one of them was, I just got the sort of text here, and there was a lady who had been loaned her boyfriend's Bentley, and she was complaining the horn didn't work. The horn was tested and found good. She said, "Not that one, this one," and pointed to the starter button. And there's a whole long list of them in the piece. It's actually a sort of fantastic little insight.
It's also we've got to remember that when the Festival of Speed started in 93, we were looking back at the 1936, when your grandfather was the first man to compete up that very road. So, you know, he did everything first, in a way, didn't he?
Yeah, and we found out all of that later, which was rather amazing. So we had the idea to do the Festival Speed, because we were obviously being restricted about what we could do on the track, and that didn't look like it was ever going to happen. So we thought, well, could we do it somewhere else? And then discovered that he'd held an event here already in 36 for the Lancer Car Club, which, as Rob said, he won himself. And we then found it. Actually, it's up there. There's a very nice little trophy, which we found in the safe, a little silver horse. It's a lighter with a little silver horse, which was the trophy for it. So it was interesting the way it all kind of it kind of fell into place once we'd had the idea.
Yeah, so it's interesting, because I thought the idea slightly came from his Lancer Owners Club event. It was actually the other way around.
Well, actually, the truth is, it was we found out, because I found all his scrapbooks later. And then miraculously, after Rob and I had been working on it for some time and trying to think how we were going to begin in explaining it and marketing the idea, I found a lovely little picture, it's not very sharp, in one of his albums of him in the Lancer going up the hill. So that became the sort of, there he was actually doing it. So then we
Amazing. I wanted to talk about, obviously, when you took over Goodwood and the introduction of the Festival of Speed and the events that we have today. The second Duke loved cricket, and there's cricket still played on the pitch. The third Duke loved horse racing, and the Goodwood Racecourse was created. The seventh Duke built the golf course. Obviously, your grandfather that we're talking about made racing happen at the Goodwood Circuit. There must have been quite a weight on your shoulders in terms of, you know, with that, on an illustrious history. Were you ever frightened of not being able to come up with these new ventures and new ideas?
No, not really. I mean, all that sort of story of sport at Goodwood hadn't really been particularly developed or told at that point. So that actually wasn't on that particular sort of angle, which is now absolutely critical to everything we do, wasn't really developed. My father had brilliantly sort of got hold of the race course and determinedly turned that into a successful, you know, retained its whole position in terms of the English summer and the social season, but also turned it into a commercially successful operation. But, you know, things were very difficult. They moved here in 1968, tax was 98%. And they moved in thinking they'd give it a go, and if it didn't really, no one had any money, really. They spent, you know, I think they spent $100,000 on the whole house, which was a lot of money then, but still, you look now, it's just... And they had to, you know, the house hadn't really been properly lived in by my grandparents since the war, so it was in very bad shape. And no one lived here, in fact. I mean, it was just opened up for the horse racing and the motor racing, and then and it was shut up again. So it was a massive... So my parents really took on a massive... That was a huge job, to just put some processes in and kind of get it going. And then really, when we developed them, having had the idea to try and get the motor circuit going and got excited and got the bit between our teeth there, then fell into the festival speed, which was a piece of luck, really. I mean, it was really... The motor circuit definitely wouldn't have turned out the way it has if we hadn't done the festival speed first. So we were given the opportunity, you know, what felt like, it felt at the time like we'd been dealt a difficult card, but actually it was the best result, really. So we had 7 years to work that out, and 7 years to realize actually the great thing about the motor circuit was it was untouched, so let's just kind of put it back to how it was. And then the idea came, because the other leases came back, the golf course lease we managed to get back, this lovely building, the kennels, came back. I then thought, well, actually, we have all these sports here. They may have been asleep, but actually, they're quite easy to wake up. And suddenly, we have horse racing, motor racing, golf, flying, shooting, and cricket all in one place, which is a unique story. And it's the authenticity around those, which is what Goodwood's really all about. As you said, I mean, over 300 years, the family have developed all these sports. That's a unique thing. But what's really unusual. Really, really unusual is the fact that they were shared in a way. So they may have raced their horses on the top of the downs. Lots of aristocrats did in the 18th century race their horses around the place against their friends, but they didn't. It wasn't a shared experience like that. The public weren't invited in. And likewise with my grandfather, he loved motor racing. But so it's interesting. Why did he suddenly want to have a hold of public? Why didn't he just go motor racing there? But he decided to hold a motor racing event. And and actually, from the moment the house was built, it was open to the public as well. So I would, you know, I'm very, very flattered, and I love it when people say to me at the Festival Speed, God, you know, it's been the best weekend of, you know, people do, you know, say this has been the best weekend I've ever had, when, you know, a 16-year-old says that, and then that's fantastic. Best weekend we've ever had in our lives, but why do you let all these people in? Why do you want all these people? Why do you let us all in here for, you know, for the weekend, 200,000 people? And actually, I think it's just a very good... The place that's sort of in the air. It's not really it's just what the place is about in a way. We don't want to. I'd love to take all the credit for that, but I don't think. I think it's just kind of how the place has developed itself, and the place has a very particular style and atmosphere, and that as that reflects well on a lot of people being able to enjoy it, and I hope having a very private experience. Because for me, the real excitement is putting on something where we have a lot of people, but everyone feels they're having their own particular moment.
There was a great, I think it's true to say as well, there was a great passion out there waiting to be satisfied in a way. At the beginning of the Festival of Speed, people used to ring up and say, I hear there's a V16 BRM coming to this event that you're doing. And I saw it when I was a boy, and I'm going to be there even if I have to crawl there. So there was that, wasn't there? There was a demand for this, for that kind of event, I think. And the same with the circuit, in the sense that when it shut, people were so disappointed. You know, why has the Duke shut the circuit? What's the problem? Why? Where are we going to go now? So I think there was all that. You know, I mean, 25,000 people turned up for the first Festival of Speed. We thought there might be 10 people.
Yeah, I mean, that was a surprise, wasn't it? I mean, you know, you say you sort of lucked into the Festival of Speed. I don't think it's obviously as simple as that, and it never is. But I think you were actually...
No, we really did it. Believe me.
But I think you were quite surprised with the sheer numbers.
I think what Rob said, I mean, obviously Rob was there at the beginning. Rob's the founding father. We had no idea of the pent-up demand. We thought there was an interest... And I guess, you know, now we say that we did the Festival Speed because we wanted to sort of see how much interest was. Actually, we did the Festival Speed because they told us we couldn't do something down there, and we bloody well wanted to do something. So we thought, well, they can't stop us doing it in front of the house because of the way the planning regulations work. Let's try it there. And then we've got a bit more, I suppose, we had to put a bit more of a serious sort of feel around the whole thing. So we said, well, look, we'll do it as a little test. Let's see if there's any interest in Goodwood and motorsport, whether anyone still makes that connection. And Rob's right in the sense then that, you know, we realised very quickly, and it was a great feeling. I mean, I think both of us would say, you know, one of the best feelings ever for sure was on the Sunday night. You know, we had such a, both good and bad in a funny way, but it had been such a sort of tumultuous weekend of, you know, ecstatic joy, huge amount of disappointment, terrible moments. You know, poor Chaz guy was killed on the first morning. You know, that was a pretty, I just thought it was all over at that point. We just thought, well, we've done a terrible thing and it's finished. So it was a weird, it was a weekend that lasted for a year in a way. But as you said, we were expecting, well, we were told, I think the BARC told us we'd be lucky to get 2,500-3,000 people for something like that, you know, a hill climb, you know, kind of not
it's
very...
It's probably a fair assumption, to be honest.
And we'd never seen it as a hill climb, so I would say that was a difference. We'd never said, no, this is not a hill climb. Yeah. This is something different. And then, of course, Doug Nye and Robert Brooks got very involved. They were extremely helpful and supportive in terms of sort of vision and what cars we, you know, and then they obviously had access to a lot of the owners, so we thought, well, actually, let's put something very different together. Then we got a little bit of sponsorship, amusingly, from Honda, Aston Martin, Robert, of course, Robert Brooks, as it was then, and Citroën a little bit, Aston Martin. And that was enough to cover some of the basic costs. And we thought, well, if anyone comes, then hopefully that'll be, you know. And amazingly, you know, I've told the story many times, but I wasn't sleeping much that week before. It was pouring with rain, actually. And I painted the bridge myself in the pouring rain, getting covered in white paint because the week before was pretty stressful. And I also ended up pretty much parking the cars. I remember standing on the side of the road, you know, I remember the Mason Styrons arriving, sort of waving them in, you go over there. And then poor Paul Ormond at Honda, who I'm sure many people will know who are listening to this, I can remember ringing him up on that first morning and giving him absolute hell down the phone, saying, Paul, you promised me the sign-on tent. You know, you told me you got, it was anywhere you were looking for, like 10 by 10 tent, if that, I mean, feet I'm talking about. It was tiny, size of this, smaller than this room. You know, where is it? He said, oh, don't worry, it's in the back of my car. You know, and I said, well, they're queuing to get in and we haven't got the tent. So, you know, so we didn't really deserve the success in many ways, but, we certainly tried hard. I mean, that's so. I think one thing we did realise was that it did have a lot. We didn't completely stumble on it in the sense that we felt it had great potential, and we did try. So we did think, how are we going to market this? How can we get it out to a lot of people? How can we get people excited? And I think maybe for the first time we presented it in a way that no event like that had been presented, in the sense that we were presenting it to the public, not to the competitors. So it wasn't a competitor event in the sense that it was only about entry fees and stuff. It was actually about the people coming to watch it. And our model ever since then has been there's no entry fee for a Goodwood event.
And when you look out the window now on a Festival of Speed morning, do you sometimes scratch your head and wonder how you've got to where it is now? Because, I mean, it's incredible. I mean, it's odd. I've only been here a couple of times when there isn't anything here. But during the Festival of Speed weekend four-day weekend, there's a whole town out there. And it really, especially with these manufacturer buildings, which are incredible, actually, just on their own. Do you ever think, blimey, how on earth has this happened? It's because of what a huge progression from that first event in 1993.
It is. I don't very much. It's bizarre how you just kind of goes on. And you know, I guess it suddenly got big, and you don't really. I mean, it's when people remind me, just even where it was 10 years ago, actually, or 7 years ago, how much it's grown in since then, even. But it's we were told the other day it was the biggest greenfield site build in the world in terms of actual scale from nothing. You know, there's nothing. There's actually a little bit under the ground there in terms of infrastructure, but basically there's nothing there. We put enough power for the whole of Chichester, so we could run the whole of Chichester with the amount of power that goes in there. So it's huge for generator companies, trackway companies. You know, it's a massive amount of... I don't know how many square metres we cover, but... There's 200 acres out there, but it's a huge build.
I mean, and how long does the setup? I mean, the setup takes weeks, doesn't it?
We have 2,000 people on site building it.
Wow,
something crazy like that. The setup is 3 months really, so it's quite a that's become quite an issue. I mean, that's quite imposing. So it's 3 months in and out. So it's 2 months in and a month out.
In wet weather. Two very wet events, and the park is just trashed. you know, it's
that's
just
a worry.
It's
an increasing worry. We're going to try and move a few things around next year to reduce that impact a bit. And this year, obviously, was very difficult because it was very wet before it. So that causes lots of problems with the parking. And you know, so that requires more infrastructure, more hard standing. And of course, what we don't want to do is we can't do that anything out here. It's a very important park. It's, you know, we can't.
We've got lots of readers' questions. And so some of them are just literally saying thank you. Who had been past visitors of the Festival of Speed and Revival and the members' meeting as well. Got a nice one here from Neil, who obviously we're talking about your grandfather earlier. He's asking, what do you think your grandfather would make of what you've achieved at Goodwood since 1993 at the Festival of Speed and then obviously at the circuit with the Revival and the members' meeting? Surely he'd be looking
he'd
down.
He'd be absolutely horrified.
Horrified, do you think?
He would think it was absolutely... He's quite interesting. I think Rob knew him a bit too. I think perhaps after a bit he'd think it was great and he'd be pleased, but most he'd probably say absolutely ridiculous. Why are you doing this? It's completely. He was very very. He looked forward a lot. He was very modern. I mean, I used to talk to him about Brooklands and say, isn't it a tragic that Brooklands? Absolutely not tragic at all. Brooklands was finished. It was over. It was old hat. Move on. And I think he might think that, you know, Goodwood, he'd close Goodwood down. I mean, there was no looking back. You know, why do you want to start up again? That's mad. But I hope he's looking down there actually with a little bit of a smile and a bit chuffed with what he created has gone on to, in some ways, perhaps, you know, and of course with, you know, the digital world we're in, we've been able to share that with so many more people around the world, and Goodwood's become known in a way we would never have dreamt of when we started it 25 years ago. It's, you know, I'm just astonished, honestly. I'm walking around Beverly Hills 2 weeks ago, and people walk up to me and say, "God, I just love your events." I think it's really bizarre. I mean, I'm not in any way wishing to sound like it's, you know, I think it's we're famous or anything, but I am absolutely amazed at how much. Goodwill there is, enthusiasm. I mean, honestly, I was in London just last weekend. Within walking from Green Park to Victoria, I had three people stop me in the street and say, "I just want to say it's great." Or and then all people chatting to me like I'm their brother. I have no bloody clue who they are. I mean, I go, "Yeah, and I see you too." And I mean, you know, but it's the best thing of all about all of it really is just that people are so. You know, there's so much good feeling about it, and they want to be part of it, and they love it. And mostly, we have, of course, there are things which don't go so well. The traffic this year was really horrible, and you know, we need to sort that out. But you know, what we find is you get something right, and then you have it right for a little bit of time, and then something happens and it goes wrong, or there's something, you know, out of your control. But mostly, we really want to do it properly, and people's feedback is very positive.
Also, if you look back. At the reasons why the Ninth Duke shut the circuit in 66, that it was the right thing to do, in the sense that the cars were becoming too quick for the circuit, and I think, with hindsight, it was a good decision because when we opened it again in 98, again that was the right time, with the right cars, in the right place, as it were. You know, it's not a circuit for modern. People say, "Oh, well, you know, you're going to have the British Grand Prix at Goodwood." I mean, forget it. So, what I'm saying is that, you know, is that probably had it gone on, it would have petered out rather than because it went out on a high. That was the thing.
Yeah.
And the great thing for us is it wasn't developed. So, the wonderful thing for us is that it hasn't ever been changed. So, he didn't try and make it fit. He decided it wasn't going to work, so he stopped it. If he tried to make it fit, or indeed if we'd started the circuit probably without doing the Festival Speed first, we might easily have, you know, not known what we were doing or just thought, well, just make it a racetrack. So we would have tried to make it fit modern racing and probably fairly, you know, uninteresting modern racing. And it would have been lost, you know, it would have been lost forever. Obviously, the interesting thing about it is that it never changed. So it's exactly as it was the day Fangio drove around it.
Yeah. We're going to come on to lots more readers' questions in a second, but I just wanted to let everyone know who is listening and watching that being at the end of November, and you can't get cross to me, Rob, because I know you hate Christmas too early. The lights are on in London, so it is nearly Christmas. We have a great Mercedes Christmas offer for you, and go to the Mercedes-Benz World website, go to the offer section, and there's loads of driving experiences from AMG ones to under 17 driving experiences and also 4x4 ones as well. So, Mum, if you're listening, I would love some time in an AMG car. So, as you know where to go now. Terms and conditions do apply, so see the website for details. We've obviously talked a little bit about the revival, but it must have been quite a struggle getting racing back there, because obviously you wanted to keep it original and to keep it all as it was in period. Just sort of give me some idea as to how tough it was to kind of get everyone to agree and the planning and everyone to say, yes, go for it.
Well, Rob knows all about this too. He was very, very involved in this process. So the moment we didn't, I suppose naively to start with, I thought it was all possible, and we thought, oh, actually, we didn't get turned down. Maybe it can happen. And then we realised fairly quickly after that. So I guess we started the Festival Speed 93, so '92, it was pretty clear it wasn't gonna happen, we remained determined though. So the FESB was meant to be just a little sort of stepping stone, and of course it turned into the monster it is now. There was a lot of resistance, but we were absolutely determined that we could get past it, and that there must be some way through. So we just carried on, and we pushed along, and it took 7 years, but we eventually got it, and we had to give up a lot to get it, actually. So obviously the amount of actual activity on the track had to reduce dramatically, no use on Sundays and all those sort of restrictions. But I remember very well, and of course then the first revival in 98 was another big, that was a big moment for us and a very exciting one.
And how are sort of relationships with sort of governing bodies and things in terms of the safety? Is that a constant battle trying to keep it as it should be in period? Or is everyone quite understanding of what you're trying to achieve and the safety record and things?
Yeah, I don't think it's a battle. I mean, we're very, very, we're all over it ourselves. We're trying to make it as safe as we possibly can all the time. So anything we think of, we will do, or we'll talk to the MSA about. I've had a very close relationship with them. Obviously, Derek Ngara at the beginning played a huge part in enabling it in the first place. I mean, if Derek hadn't said, so it was because I was talking to Derek about the circuit, and I didn't know him well, but Dennis Carter, the BARC, I was really involved with the BARC, and Dennis had put me in touch with Derek. Derek was coming down to look at the circuit, talk about banks, and did we have to have Armco all around it? What was it going to mean? Because I knew that would wreck it. That I then brought him up here and said, look, we've had this little idea about doing something in front of the house, which Ian Back suggested, who was a member of the BARC, bizarrely at a funeral we were both at together. He suddenly said, you ought to run a hill climb in front of the house, and I said, that'll never happen. That you can't be you serious? He said, yeah, I think you could do it. And that's actually, to be fair, it was Ian. That's how the whole thing came about. And then think, well, we don't really want a British, we don't want a sort of international hill climb, we just want to, how could we do something a bit different? And then it was Derek, I remember showing him, and I was going to go from the kennels at the beginning, all the way up past the west entrance, and then at the crossroads, take a left up here. And he looked at that and was sucking his teeth in a bit, because there were quite a lot of walls and
immovable
hairy
objects.
Corners, super quick, quite hairy corners and... So I was a bit disappointed. He said, well, I don't think and then we had a little dry run. He said, but I think you could do it this way, down there. And then, of course, Derek brilliantly. Again, we were very, very lucky. So, because if Derek had said, that's all fine, but you can do it, but you're going to have to put Armco from top to bottom. I mean, we would never have done it, because it would have cost so much. We just couldn't have done it. And the beauty of the event for Goodwood, and why it's been so fantastic for the estate, is it hasn't required a great deal of capital. It's just, we've just done it. And been able to repeat it, and then earn the money and do it again. So we've been able to put all that money back into the estate. And it's had a massive impact on what we've been able to do here and keeping the whole place alive and well. So it was a brilliant event at the beginning. And Derek, those who were here will well remember Not only was there a BRM V16, which made grown men cry, which Rob mentioned earlier, which was an amazing... I realised then we must be onto something when they got so emotional about it. But there was a string line. It was literally a piece of string. And Derek was sitting in his car, I remember, on the first corner, and a lot of people going, God, this looks quite serious. And Derek said, it's fine, it's a rally stage, as far as I'm concerned. It's just like a rally stage. So that was brilliant that he... And he could see exactly what we were trying to do. We weren't trying to, you know, run an international time trial or something. It was a celebration of the motor car. And his understanding played a massive part at the beginning. Derek had just said at the beginning, this is never going to work. If he hadn't slightly, you know, stepped out of line and said, this looks like exciting, this is great for everybody, let's do it, it would never have happened. So he's there's a lot to thank him for.
Mm. I'm wary of, you've got more meetings to go, more important meetings to go to. But I'm just going to, there's lots of things I just want to quickly touch on. You've obviously had some amazing stars from Mario Andretti to Valentino Rossi, and some, you know, there's probably about four podcasts just in some of those stories. Was there a story about Mario Andretti and a jigsaw?
So I think there was indeed. It was a very wet year. It was the Ferrari year. Mario was here, 97. And it rained, and we had Rick Mears here, we had lots of great, we had all the Indy drivers here as well, Danny Sullivan, Mario's wife, all the wives were here as well, and they were all staying in the house, and though they didn't go out at all, I think the whole weekend, all they did was sit and do a jigsaw, which my wife, Janet, loves a proper jigsaw, so we always have a big jigsaw out, these lovely hand-cut things. And they got to pretty much the end of the jigsaw after dinner one evening, and everyone was getting quite excited and the last piece was bloody missing. So the girls were all pretty, everyone was a bit, there was a slight, yeah. No, it was a bit of disappointment. And the next morning, everyone's sitting down, and Mario comes bouncing in his overalls on, ready to go up to the track, and suddenly goes, oh, gee, look. And pops the last piece of the bloody jigsaw into it. And he'd taken it at the beginning of the week and popped it in his pocket, it seemed. Anyway, very competitive racing driver, kind of poor behaviour. Yeah. So that was...
I liked it when Froilan Gonzalez came to drive the... the V16 BRM up the hill. It was a fantastic thing to get him here at all.
The Pampas Bull.
Yeah, the Pampas Bull, all the way from Argentina. He's quite an elderly man, of course, and the time came for his run in the BRM on the hill, and there was and we were all thinking, where is he? And the announcement came over the PA in the paddock: Mr. Gonzalez is having breakfast. His run will be postponed.
Yeah. Brilliant. A lot of people spend a lot of time in bed here over the weekends, actually.
I know it's
too many stories to tell about.
Yeah. Well, it is a family show, but I do know that when the rooms were being cleaned the day after the Festival of Speed a few years ago, I won't tell you which year it was, a thong was discovered hanging from an orchid that had been used in a room.
The orchid was at the end of the bed, actually. Yeah,
at the end of the bed.
It took a bit of time to see it, and no one noticed it for quite a long time. So, you know, the orchid being what it is, and then the thong hanging, it was like perfectly camouflaged.
And of course, we are talking a Formula One driver here.
Right. Who else? But there was didn't Emerson, is there an Emerson go around the track in a Rolls Royce with...
That was very recently, actually. That was very recently. So we had the big, Jean Todt kindly bought the whole, we had the big FIA conference here. So they were all here. And... Gerhard Berger was here as well. Emerson happened to be here that evening. Jean Todt and I. And they did a big dinner down at the motor circuit. And I think it was probably Gerhard, probably predictably, said, you don't think we need to be doing some, we need to drive, did some driving. In the, you know, it was dark. It was pouring with rain. And I had the Phantom down there. So I said, okay, we'll go for Emerson, you drive. And so we had Emerson driving, me in the front, and Gerhard and Jean Todt in the back going flat out round the circuit in the dark. Anyway, I thought, if anything happens now, we're all going to be in big trouble. And you can imagine Gerhard was pushing Emerson on, telling him he was, you know. Yeah.
There's a question here from
the wipers.
There's a question here. There's lots of questions actually from various people. There's one here from Greg on this, all on the same topic, but saying, you know, you have a racetrack, a hill climb course, and a rally stage on your doorstep. Do you ever get tempted to sneak out at night and have a blast around them in something tasty? I think that probably answers that question actually.
Very, very rarely now. Is Robert will remember that. God, when sort of 17, 18, we were out on the track. He's going to do 70 laps straight off. My son zooms out on the rally. Well, goes out on the rally stage a bit. We got a fantastic off road. Rage, which he's quite decent in, and we have a good thrash around there, and we have some fun people who come and done that with us, and that's very, you know, and then that's a bit damp and it's chalky, it's really, really difficult.
I got to tell you, he did try the Festival of Speed course downhill many years ago, but it only lasted halfway because
wasn't a great result.
He drove his mother's Mustang 1100 flat out into a very large tree and spent several weeks in hospital.
4 months, in fact, in hospital.
Really?
Yeah. Was not my best moment. Yeah, my mother was out. I was joyriding. I was 16, and I went up to the top with a friend in the car. Yeah, I whipped it round. You know, came zooming back down, and it was one of those terrible MG 1100s with that molten suspension. You know, when one goes up, the other goes down. One of the, anyway.
And
I lost it badly on the last corner coming down. Yeah, and ended up absolutely stuffed into these trees. wasn't good. Broke my legs.
Every racer has to have a big shunt. So.
It's quite a big one. Just a couple more questions. This is from Matt in South Korea. There's been so many great cars and drivers at Goodwood events over the past 20 years. Is there a particular car or driver you look back on most fondly?
Well, probably. There are funny enough, immediately you say that, there are two moments I remember. One was I came out of the dining room window here, because the window is all open. I climbed out of the dining room window Friday the Festival Speed, and I'm just walking. I've just stepped onto the lawn, and a guy runs smack into me, and it almost knocks me over. He knocks himself over. He pulls himself up and says, "Oh, gee, I'm so sorry, man. I'm so sorry. I'm just in such a hurry. I've got to go and see the Chaparrals." And I thought, he's American. And anyway, this guy came all the way from Chicago to see the Chaparrals, which had never been seen in America, really, because Jim had put them all away. And so for me to have the we've had them here a few times, obviously, since. But that was a big moment. So at the beginning, getting all those Indy cars, getting the note. I mean, we tried so hard to get some of these cars. I mean, to get a V6, to get an Auto Union at the beginning, you know, they were not, there weren't any in the world. I mean, we were, you know, there was one in East Germany. So to try and get those blockbuster cars at the beginning, they were real triumphs. The W165 Mercedes, when they rebuilt that specially and brought that was it. That was a big moment. But to have the Chaparrals here and to drive them, so very few people have driven a Chaparral. So for me, the bizarre thing perhaps is that I used to dream about all these cars when I was a child, and I've driven most of them, which is extraordinary. You know, I've now driven, I'm the only three people in the world have driven a Chaparral, pretty much, and Phil Hill and me, and you know, so, I don't know, you know, very, very few people have driven one, and you know, I've had some unbelievable experiences. And the other one was, I think, seeing Dan Gurney fiddling with the Gurney Westlake when it first came. You know, he didn't think it was running quite right, so there was Dan leaning over with his head, all these spanners out, and there was Gurney rebuilding his own engine. That was, you know, those were, so he's a big driver for me.
Yeah. What was it like having Rossi here finally? That must have been another
brilliant,
sort of another good moment.
He was such great company. And he loved it. All he could say all the time was what a great time he was having. And I got a sweet note from him afterwards asking me to go and see his garage and his family at Silverstone, which was, and I spent a little bit of time with him before the British race. And he was just charming, and he wouldn't leave the party, and we had such a good time. And, you know, he's a superstar.
I think he cancelled his flight home so he could drive one more car up the hill.
Yeah.
He was there. I mean, it tells you a lot about the guy, doesn't it?
Yeah, I remember watching, because I kept seeing him in more and more cars. And really was like a child in a playground.
It was like the incredible Pope. When he came on the balcony over the front of the house, it was like the Pope, wasn't it? Well, it was bigger than the Pope, actually.
It was one of our best moments, him riding in the bike, for sure.
Basically out of time. Obviously, not many people are listening or watching. Who's the sort of star guest for next year, and what have we got to look forward to? Or are we too early in the season?
Lots of secrets, really. Yeah, I mean, the theme is all about the major moments in motorsport which have changed the sport forever. There's sort of blockbuster developments that have the sort of high water marks, and that means we've got to get the most exciting cars and obviously all the drivers that go with them. So no, there's some excitements already. It looks good.
Excellent. Well, Lord Marsh, thank you so much for spending so much time. I'm sorry we've run over a little bit. Rob, thank you very much for joining us as well.
Oh, it's
a
pleasure.
Giving your insight as the veteran as podcaster. And Alan, thank you so much for recording all the sound as beautifully as you always do. We'll see you all next month for one final motorsport podcast before the end of the year. See you then. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Some things are made to cope with puddles and rain. Others deal with the stickiest of mud. And as for the snow, that takes a warm coat and sure footing. But when it comes to dealing with all conditions, there's only one thing that springs to mind. Mercedes-Benz 4MATIC. All-wheel drive performance in any condition. So whatever the weather or road throws at you, you're ready. To see the 4MATIC range for yourself, visit your local Mercedes-Benz retailer.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads. Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.